from a source of signal, which is in the, let me call it, 1 to 30 watt category, as opposed to the nearest television broadcast station, which at that time was transmitting analog UHF television, channel 21, roughly 50,000 watts. But that analog station in Syosset was, I don't know the exact number, 15 miles away, crow-flies, maybe 20 miles away. Even though that transmitter is tremendously stronger, by the inverse square law, that television signal from 15 or 20 miles away compared to the local signal 200 feet away, my calculation tells me the local signal would have to be stronger. I see where you're going, but not likely. Now, if that television broadcast station was in the town with them, I'm in your ballpark. I agree with you. But that television broadcast station, which UHF television broadcast in effective radiated power, is about the most powerful transmitters we have in the area, with the exception of a particular radar if you happen to sit right in the middle of its pencil beam. But its pencil beam is continuously rotating, so you can't do that. So within reason, the strongest transmitters we can encounter are UHF television. Higher frequency, higher power, more antenna gain. So effective radiated power, UHF television transmitters, about the most powerful things they are. But they're on 200 and 300 foot and 400 foot towers with a pancake pattern aimed at the horizon. Unless you climb the tower, you can't create a risk from that. Or, let me drop.
Get.
If you were foolish enough to locate yourself on a 300 foot hook and ladder out in front of that antenna, on a 300 foot high hook and ladder, and you located yourself 5 feet or 10 feet from that antenna, you could create a biohazard for yourself. But that's, you see how difficult that is. Howie number one, hold on for a minute. Let's make sure I'm back on the right subject here for Howard number two. KC2OJO, K2LIW.
Yeah, I was just curious. I realize that the inverse square law, I certainly do. But at the same time, it seems to me there might be a fair number of sources that are a lot closer than we think, including natural background radiation and so forth, whether it's from the sun, that's pretty far away, obviously, at 93 million miles. But, when you tune your radio receiver, you get a hell of a lot of static all the way across, up and down the bands. And I wonder what that doesn't integrate to in a fraction of a microvolt per meter compared to some of the other signals that people are worried about.
99% of the time, Howard, when you tune your radio and you hear noise in the background, in the case of a VHF radio, a high percent of the noise you're hearing is from the first stage of amplification of your radio. I will admit, when you get down to HF frequencies and medium frequencies, yes, you're now hearing galactic noise, atmospheric noise, ionospheric noise. You've got 50,000 thunderstorms going on planet Earth at any one instant of time, and every one of those zillions of lightning bolts are all making a burst of noise, and they all get combined together, reflected by the ionosphere, and they come into your radio. And so, as bad as that sounds, in microvolts per meter, it's an extremely strong, small signal. And when it comes to background, you hit the nail on the head when you said sun. Even though it's 93 million miles away, the sun puts out an amount of power, which is 10 to the 27 power, one with 27 zeros after it. A really big number. That's the number of watts of solar power coming out of that sun. When you lay on the beach in Greenlawn at Sunken Meadow Park, so to speak, on a sunny day, 1,000 watts of solar energy is striking your body. That is a significant source of energy. If you call that background, I better call that front foreground. That's potent. But you can see that under reasonable conditions, that thermal energy the sun hits you with, 1,000 watts, your body can tolerate. You have been tuned to survive this planet. If you believe in evolution, you have evolved a body that tolerates 1,000 watts of thermal power going into it. The 30 watts out of a light bulb 200 500 feet away, it's got to be extremely safe. And as I've said before, all of this research for 60 years has been looking for the non-thermal effect, and they haven't found it. When radio energy at such a low frequency, speaking now in the standards of ultraviolet and X-ray and whatever, radio energy is at such a low frequency, the energy it contains is so low. It's so low that it doesn't have the ability to do that damage. And there's only the thermal effect. Mr. HWW, go right ahead, Howie. H-U-L-I-W.
Are these people willing to give, are they actually willing to give up their technology? You think that's just the end thing they're doing right now? Most of these people are professionals. They use computers. They need to use cell phones to conduct their businesses. Are you telling me they're actually willing to give it all up?
They do not use their laptops when the child is in the house. They will not use a microwave oven. They do not use their cell phone when they're in the vicinity of their child. When they must make a cell phone call, they go out of the house, into the car, if the child is not in the car. Their belief is that strong. Howie, go ahead.
Does that mean they're not going to let their kids get the latest iPods? I mean, you know what? Then, you know what? They have that right. And if, you know, if society wants to go back to the easier, if enough people vote with their pocketbook, you know, that's their prerogative. It's a little scary. And I can tell you, from people who are involved with repeaters and everything else, it's a scary thing out there. So we both agree it is most likely very, very safe. But if they're not willing to use it, see, what are they saying? They're saying that they're willing to hurt themselves, but they don't want to hurt their kids. So they're saying basically they don't care if they kill themselves, but they love their kids enough.
If you do enough reading, Howard, you will find out that both the United Kingdom and their Radiological Protection Board has made a recommendation, not a law, a recommendation, that you do not hand the cell phone to a five-year-old child so that they can talk to grandma. The philosophy is that a young child is producing brand new cells so rapidly as he is developing. Brain material and other material is happening so rapidly in a child that the belief is that a child is much more vulnerable to the deleterious effects of some local source of radiant energy. Therefore, the recommendation is you don't expose a child to it. That's a strongly felt belief in the United Kingdom today. So I am guessing, that the residents of the town have read such reports. Therefore, they're protecting their children. The belief is that a adult human being is a lot less vulnerable. You're not developing brand new cells and brand new brain material and whatever so rapidly. And they have already propagated, they have already done their reproduction, so to speak, and they believe they're relatively safe by comparison. They are protecting their children, Howie, and they think they're sincere. I believe they are. They're misinformed, but it's going to take a slow educational process. This situation is not going to go away in a hurry. Someone else wants to make a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2LIW.
Hey, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
Now, a couple of things. Write this down, Dick. This is a good website for you. This is, you remember I spoke about Rigitel quite a while ago. It's called RadHaz, RADHAZ.com. www.radhaz. I think you'll find some interesting reading there. By the way, what got you started on this? I mean, this has been a rather regular subject for you, and you're spending quite a lot of time on it tonight, but no problem. Actually, the folks there should get rid of the cable because cable leaks and causes more radiation than the cell towers do. I know. By the way, what are you using for making your RFR measurements with? And for all the years that you couldn't eat clams and snails and stuff like that out of the water, they should close all the beaches so that way nobody can get cancer. K2RW, K2D.
What brought this up again is the fact that I'm disappointed that I can no longer communicate with my relatives who live in that town, because if you express an opinion different in that town, you're persona non grata. A ham radio operator I met on this repeater 3 weeks ago, I found out used to live in Bayville. I asked him to talk to his friends. He has a close relative who lives in the town. I asked him to talk to that close relative. A close relative of his happens to have a wife who is a teacher in the town. And he can no longer discuss that subject. And so I ran into him this week, and I suddenly realized that the subject is now so delicate, it can't be discussed. And I suddenly come to the conclusion, corrective action has got to be applied here. This is a slightly runaway condition, that this erroneous myth has really gotten out of hand. And Bayville is not the only town. Old Bethpage, Hicksville, and I can't think of the name of the town out east on the South Fork. East Hampton? Yeah, I think it's East Hampton. The village of East Hampton also has a problem like this. And you can't locate a cell phone base station in Oyster Bay town itself. They won't allow it. And the one that got in there, they want it to die. They won't allow you to go in and repair it because they believe it has this danger. Again, it's an erroneous opinion that's got to be corrected. It's a condition that's gotten out of hand. People will die if this condition is not corrected.
Well, it's time for you to write an op-ed piece in Newsday, you know?
January issue of Newsday 2009 on the front cover had this exact story. And the district attorney, assistant district attorney of Nassau County, said that if they succeed in their lawsuit to remove the antennas from that water tower in that town, that she will declare the property eminent domain. She will condemn the property, declare it by eminent domain, and put the antennas back. It's a lawsuit that cannot be won. It is wasting money, time, and anguish because of an erroneous myth that needs correcting. Yeah, why did I bring it up now? How much longer should we wait? How much more grief should happen? How many more people should perish because of improper communication services? If I, as an electronic engineer, understanding how radio works, how much protection it provides, and if I don't get involved in trying to apply corrective action, in my mind, I'm on the threshold of criminally negligent homicide. I'm allowing people to die that would not have to die. My feeling is becoming that strong. Back to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. I actually know a whole bunch of people up there in Bayville. And, you know, they're in summer houses, which we've been converted to, you know. It's just so silly. The folks that I know don't subscribe to that. By the way, Old Bethpage doesn't have a mayor it's not a village, it's an unincorporated village. It's not even I don't know who those people are going to, but there in Old Bethpage, they got a big problem because they have big towers in a few places, not just cell towers. Go to Richard Chell's site. I think you'll find some interesting reading there. Also, his original report of the World Trade Center is on there, which I have. I took a couple of RF safety courses with this guy. He's really good. I'm surprised. If you didn't know the name last time, but it's radhaz.com. You should go there and spend a little time. I think you'll enjoy it. It covers everything from various different places, including the phone companies, and even goes as far as showing you protective clothing. You know, he's in business, but still his information is pretty good. And by the way, what did you use for an RFI meter? Did you use an auto or something else?
Excuse me.
I had two of them. I had both a NADA as well as a antenna and spectrum analyzer. And you're talking about Richard Tell Associates at radhaz.com. Looks like a good website. Glad you brought it to our attention. Howie, you want to make a comment? Go ahead.
I'd ask Gary if he took his certification course. I went for a one-day course that was given at Condé Nast for the Broadcasting Society, and you got a certification that you were certified to work on towers, or you had the knowledge of how to protect yourself from RF.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, well, generally the buildings, including Empire, we'll say we had regular refresher courses too. So not only was the OSHA course required, RF course, RF safety course was required, and a OSHA tag and lockout course was required too, because when they, they get really extreme, although one of these days, Dick, I'll show you the videos that I took when they were putting the DTV antennas on top of the World Trade Center, and all the pretty pictures of these guys going up in these buckets that are held up by a single quarter-inch sky wire from a pulley that was mounted at the very top of the mast. It's really wild stuff, but, it's mandatory for them to do this whole, it's like a military procedure when it comes to working on antennas on buildings like that, because you're talking multiple megawatts of energy coming out. And, look, I've climbed up the inside of the damn thing while it's on. I have my little portable RFR meter. It goes off, but, do I really care? I mean, it's sort of like the, you work with this stuff. It is. I mean, I've got the burns on my fingers from sticking my hands in the wrong places, but, And then, of course, then there's the other side of the coin, where you get the cop who's got the 10 gigahertz radar, and he's worried that he's going to become impotent. So, where do you go? Individuals have their own way of thinking about certain things, too. It's like, prejudice comes in all forms. K2IW, K2IW.
Yeah, that's running us by again. The main mast at the World Trade Center, that 350-foot mast with a zillion antennas on it, radiating a lot of power. You told me you climbed up the inside of that mast with a RadHaz meter with you. Out of curiosity, how high did it read, and how long did you roll there? That sounds like quite a story here. Eric, go ahead.
Now, if you remember, I've shown you pictures of what that mast looks like. That mast was actually designed by Oda Bendev, who was, at the time, the chief engineer of RCA, because RCA built that mast, and you should see the pictures of them putting it together. The final picture is of, the riggers up at the top, mooning New York, which was really, really funny. But that mast was put together in three pieces, but that was in 1968 or 69, whenever it was that it was designed. But that mast has a series of, not ladders, but staircases inside, so you can get up. The last 30 or 40 feet was a straight ladder, but it still wasn't that bad. So, you actually didn't have to turn any of this stuff off. Well, you did kind of. There were some antennas that you would want to shut off if you went up to the top, but, it's pretty well shielded inside.
Rich recognized, I presume you were communicating with the people down below with a handy talkie. Does a handy talkie continue to operate in that environment? You had a radiation hazard meter with you. How high did it read? That sounds like an exciting climb up the inside of that mast at the World Trade Center. And I did see a picture of you and Dr. Bill down at the base of the tower, right after you guys had installed the high-definition television equipment, which I think was a couple of weeks from the incident. So when you climbed up that mast, how long did you dwell? How high did it read? And does a handy-talkie work? Back to you, Eric.
In general, handy-talkies don't work very well up there to start with. But at the time that we were climbing, wasn't when everybody was on full power, a lot of stuff is on standby antennas. So, but the kind of meter that I had was, the little pocket one that blurts after it. I don't remember what the value is. I think it was like 10 morads, something like that. It wasn't that high, but it wasn't that low either. It wasn't another that you could actually point and, get a real accurate reading. It's one of those, it's sort of like you can think of it as the guys who work with the radiation, a little strip of film. But, once you go past a certain level of damping, it just buzzes at you.
Yeah, in those days, I think the standard was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. You said 10 millirad. you're thinking nuclear. Milliwatts per square centimeter is the RF unit often used. 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is, I think, 10 watts per square meter. If I got it correctly, yes it is. 10 watts per square meter is 1 milliwatt per square
Milliwatts per square meter, sorry.
Kind of thought so. Yeah, the new standard is 1 milliwatt per square centimeter for an uncontrolled environment. Uncontrolled environment means that the person doesn't know he's being exposed.
They're talking about public exposure.
Yeah, whereas 10 milliwatts per square centimeter is what I think you're allowed.
It still is.
Say again?
It still is in a controlled environment.
When you know, yes. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead.
Hey, Dick, you know who might be a good spokesman? The people who used to work at NBC on the 86th War of Empire. I remember back in the 70s when Barry, N2MB, was working up there. I went up there with him one night. I wanted to see what the transmitter room looked like. The place was literally bathed in RF. And these guys were bathed in RF from the day they got in there to the day they got old and retired, and nothing happened to them. I remember Barry took out a P&K transistor checker. You could not use it up there or use a solid-state voltometer unless it was bypassed with capacitors, and even then, I remember the transistor checker, the needle would just sit there at half scale.
And what you're describing is a pretty hot environment as far as a radio receiver is concerned. A modern-day sensitive radio that can receive a signal of a fraction of a microvolt, and you give it a signal of a millivolt out of its rubber duck antenna, that is a signal that is, let me think, 1,000 to 1, million, it's a million.
You're whacking the front end.
Oh yeah, that's 60 dB above threshold, if I got the numbers right. And so you're really at the threshold of overpowering the radio, even though it's well below what was then the standard. 192 volts per meter was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. 192 volts per meter. And all the radio needs to be overloaded is about a millivolt or so. And we're talking about volts per meter. Are still safe. So what makes your instrumentation go crazy? Your transistor checker and your radios and your handy talkies all go crazy. It's still far from a radio signal strength that represents a radio frequency biohazard to human beings, or let's call it biological material. So there's a lot of dBs of safety factor in there. That's not obvious. If every instrument you are using goes haywire, a rational person in that circumstance, without doing another calculation, will say, wow, boy, am I being exposed. Well, maybe not. And again, it's only thermal. If you're not feeling any heat, you might be safe. When it comes to psychosomatic situations, let me drop. On a couple of occasions, I've ran into somebody who made the mistake of putting his hand across a waveguide of something that was transmitting a few watts of power. And he was positive. This happened to me 3 times in the last 20 years. 3 different individuals put their hand across the microwave or one of them on an antenna directly and felt the heat and then suddenly retracted his hand. And I could tell by the nature of the questions they asked me, each of those people were positive that they were going to get cancer in that hand. It's just a matter of time. They were positive. They were positive their life was over, so to speak, that their hand is going to have to be amputated. Hand, arm, whatever. And so when you feel the heat in your hand, whether your hand is out in the sun, in front of the hot air coming off some piece of instrumentation, over the burner of an oven, of a range, that doesn't mean you're going to get cancer. And RF creating that amount of heating is not necessarily dangerous to your hand. That amount of heating to your eye, the eye is the most sensitive part of the human being. You got to be careful. There are people who got a cataract in their eye because day after day they would love sitting in front of their fireplace staring into those hot red glowing coals. And the total heat given to their cornea day after day eventually gave them a cataract. Your eye is very thermally sensitive. And your eye does not have a good sense of temperature. I know because a buddy of mine goes skiing He's a very enthusiastic guy, and he used to have to sometimes periodically stop, hold his hand in front of his eye, because some of the tears around the perimeter of his eye had frozen, and it became uncomfortable to his eyelid, not to his eye. Your eye does not sense temperature, unfortunately, and it's a very temperature-sensitive item, so you got to be careful. Protect your eye.
One more comment, and I must go.
Go ahead with your comment.
Hey, you know, there's no blood vessels there to take away the heat.
There's very little fluid flow for the eye. That is the problem. Go ahead, Howie.
And so that's a fact. If you believe something, it's mind over matter. And that's what's happening to a lot of people. They get themselves into a loop. They think something is going to happen. And that's it. I know someone who thought that they were getting hot from an antenna and a transmitter was even hot.
Okay, why would it come in?
Mel recognized. Very similar to the people in France. In this very recent case this year, where they were getting nosebleeds and a metallic taste in the mouth because they thought that cell phone next to their apartment building had been turned on. And they're going through these frantic efforts of putting tinfoil on the windows, as if the windows are the only part of the building that's transparent. Depending on what the wall's made out of radio-wise, it's transparent also. K2KUI, K2RIW. What's going to correct all this, Mel? Tell us how to get out of this problem.
Tell you exactly. Back in the late, I guess it was the late '60s, I was working for Zenith, and we were installing monitors at NASA in Houston, Texas. And it started a whole routine, if you remember, about color TV sets, whether it be monitors or regular home TV, whatever, were giving off radiation. And what they did, they made everybody that worked for the company carry or put in his pocket this thing called a dosimeter. I think you call it a dosimeter. It was like a, looked like a pen, and it had a lens on one side, and you plugged it into this device, and it lit up, and this little scale inside would move if you were being exposed to any kind of radiation. Well, P.S., I had that in my pocket for God knows how long. Who knows, maybe a year or so. Never moved an inch, Dick, but maybe that's the answer. Give out these dosimeters and tell everybody, well, you'll bring it in, your dosimeter in, and we'll show you. Well, you can look in the little lens and see if you're being exposed to radiation, over.
Yeah, I own one of those dosimeters, Mel. The way it works is that you connect it to a machine which charges it. I think the machine used to contain a 67-volt battery. So the center conductor would be charged to 67 volts. The electrostatic repulsion would move a little whisker that's in there against a scale. And then you would unplug it. It would make no longer make contact to the outside world. And this charged capacitor, about a 1 picofarad capacitor, if radiation went through the side of the dosimeter, would create an ionized trail through the gas that was in there, and it would discharge that capacitor, and the whisker would move back towards zero, so to speak, which really was the dose you were exposed to. Unfortunately, that type of dosimeter only responds to a rather hard kind of x-rays. The extremely soft x-rays you get out of a 30 kilovolt power supply on a color television tube is not hard enough to make that meter respond. It's the wrong kind of meter, I've been told by my people who understand these kind of radiation dosimeters. I own one of those. I asked the question, will it respond? And he said, yes, it will respond maybe to the x-rays you get in the dental office. It might respond to that. It might not. But the x-rays off of the television set are much too soft. It cannot respond to that. They will not penetrate the case of that dosimeter. K2KUI, K2RIW. I got a guess as to why you didn't get any action out of it.
Getting action out of it, period. I don't care. I was playing with my ham equipment. I was working. I was in the sun, my beach, and everything like that. And it was always in my pocket for, I don't know why I carried it. Sort of got indoctrinated. Well, I guess I was also kind of, curious what will move this thing. You know, something, everything I did, Dick, and I was up to, into commercial broadcasting stations and everything, this thing never moved, so I don't know what it would take to move it, but I would assume that everyday life did not have enough energy somewhere to find it, to, you know, to move it. Did you ever see yours move? Over.
No, I did not. What if they're intended for? If you were working in a nuclear refining plant, if you were working at that place in Washington where they're refining nuclear fuels, and you got things like uranium and cesium and whatever, the individual particles of spontaneous radiation from a nuclear emitting substance, those individual particles coming flying out of there, neutrons in general, come flying out at an extremely high rate, and they've got a lot of energy. Each individual particle can penetrate a whole lot of biological material, can easily penetrate the metallic case on your dosimeter, create a partial discharge, and create a change in the reading. So what we're talking about here is the amount of energy of the cosmic ray, gamma ray, whatever, alpha, beta, gamma, if you know what I mean.
And alpha and beta ain't going to kick it. It's got to be gamma or higher.
You're absolutely right. So it's the real particle that's got to do it. Not the alpha, I think, is the electrons, doesn't have enough energy. The beta is the radio-like energy, doesn't have enough energy. But the gamma, the nuclear particle itself, the neutrons and protons that come flying out of there, they have enough energy, they do damage, they move that kind of a dosimeter. You just weren't exposed to the right kind of radium, cesium, uranium, those kind of materials. That's what would move it, I think, Mel, go ahead.
Hey, Mel, were you working in a TV factory? It was at a point in time where they had just started putting leaded glass on the front of the picture tube.
Unfortunately, Derek, if you remember what happened, I don't know how it started, but somebody some way exposed an X-ray piece of film by putting it up against the screen of a picture tube, a color tube, and that's where it started. Oh, it got on to the news, everything on. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon for a while there. You don't know, it was almost, you know, a panic started setting people with color TVs. Oh, boy, I don't want that radiation out of my color TV. Oh, on and on, if you remember correctly. In fact, all the manufacturers like Venus and RCA, of course, Dumont, at the time, who else? Philco, you know, Admiral, all those American companies at the time had to send out their service technicians with a high voltage meter to make sure that the high voltage was not exceeding, I think they said, like, what was it, 25,000 or something at the time on the second anode as the safety factor. So what I'm saying to you, Dick, give everybody, if they think they're getting some kind of radiation from a... like nuclear radiation, give them one of these dosimeters in the town. Give everybody one of them and say, well, let's see what you're exposed to. You'll bring it in periodically. You'll get online. Everybody will get online. We'll all look into this little thing, and we'll see what you're getting exposed to. Then maybe that'll be convincing. Over.
There you go.
Yeah, but because they don't believe their own consulting firm, a well-respected, expensive consulting firm, who did a significant survey that went on for months and published about a 40-page report, because it didn't say what they wanted to hear, they didn't believe it. Now, the problem is not that simple. When it comes to putting X-ray sensitive film against the surface of a television cathode ray tube, where little bitty static discharge is taking place, and if you did it in a dark room with a dark tube, you would see the little blue glow, so to speak. I'm asking Eric, are those kinds of film photosensitive, where it's maybe responding to the electrostatic discharge at the surface of the tube, not the so-called X-rays coming out of the tube? K2KEY, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, they had these things called dosy strips, and there was actually a fine-grained, relatively fast film. If a particle came by, or even X-rays came by, it would actually fire off the halides, and you get little spots of fog. But you never knew if the film was handled properly when it was put in the clip, because any little bit of static discharge, of course, will make the halide change state. So, but it's, you know, it's been used very successfully for many years, and it's still being used in nuclear power plants and stuff. But as with any kind of film, you know, whether using light or using some other form of energy to make the exposure, the film has a reciprocity need, it has a curve, and it's logarithmic in nature, so very little exposure doesn't really show much until you get to a certain point on the knee where it actually exposes a lot of the halides. So, but they are actually sensitive to soft x-rays as well as hard x-rays as opposed to the dosimeters.
But I'm pretty sure, Eric, you have, particularly on a dry day, often walked up to a cathode ray tube, put your hand near the actual glass, and because of your electrostatic discharge, you would hear a little zit-zit-zit-type sound. You put photosensitive film or electrostatically sensitive film in that environment, press it up against that glass, potentially it's going to give you an exposure, which could give you a false alarm, thinking that there's x-rays coming out of the surface of that cathode ray tube. Back to you, Eric, for a comment on that one.
Actually, I remember when way back when that business started, especially, it actually started from, I think, my Motorola set with a high voltage regulator when it got lost, and it went up to like 35,000 or 40,000 volts. I remember in those days a couple of experiments were done to isolate it to keep it from being electrostatically affected. Because, I mean, you can go up to any TV set and, you know, put your arm next to it and you can see the hair on your hands move, you know, on your arm. That's how you know the high voltage is going. But if you take regular photographic film, like people, as I remember this story went, it was a black and white film. The guy put a key in front of it, so that way the key would have, you know, would leave a shadow, and put it in front of the set for a couple of days, you know, taped it up to the glass. And I think this was before they actually started making it mandatory to use leaded glass for the front of the CRT.
Okay, so when you developed that film, you saw the outline of the key. However, was the film being exposed because of electrostatic discharge, or was it really being exposed because of x-rays coming off that tube? That x-ray machine that you're experiencing at a dentist when he does a dental x-ray, I vaguely remember the one that my dentist used to use had a voltmeter on it, and I think the voltage on that x-ray tube was 350 kilovolts. That's a significant x-ray. The 28 kilovolts you've got on a color cathode ray tube is such a much lower voltage that by definition those so-called x-rays coming out of there are extremely soft. I'm not convinced they can even penetrate the glass if the glass wasn't leaded. K2EJ, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a question.
Glenn recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
I remember, you know, I can look it up. There were a number of experiments done back in those days. Again, when you take a, you know, I'm not going to answer the question as to whether it was being exposed electrostatically. I don't remember precisely, so I'm going to go look into past history and find out what the exact answer is, because I believe that was a question that was brought up, and that was eliminated by some method, and I don't remember exactly what it is. But the electrostatic effect is going to be have less energy than if you actually get an actual x-ray through the glass. And I do remember that the regulator in the set had allowed the high voltage to hit, you know, the upper 40s, and somehow or other it emitted soft x-rays. So the original bulbs without the leaded glass actually are not that thick. So, you know, x-rays passing through it is not such a bad thing, not such a hard thing. When you're generating that kind of energy at 300,000 volts, and I don't know if I remember this, I have to look that up too. I think that number's a little bit high. I think it's 35,000 or 40,000. So, and think about it. In the old days, generating that much energy. But today, of course, you know, they have these little scanners instead of film that they put in your mouth, and the amount of x-rays that they actually use to produce the image now is I think, 30 to 40 times less than what they use for film. So, you know, everybody's going green. K2IW, K2K.
K2KY.
Mel Rickmeyer, that's a Glenn. When you peel a piece of scotch tape in the dark, you will see a blue glow at the exact line along the tape where a layer of tape is being separated. Peeling scotch tape under normal circumstances gives you some very high voltages, and people have done some studies. X-rays are coming off the high voltage created at the intercept point where the tape is being peeled. A very soft kind of X-rays are being created by just peeling scotch tape. And if you work with electrostatic sensitive electronics and you peel scotch tape nearby, you may be taken away from that place and never be allowed to work there again. You're violating one of their strict rules about ESD exposure and creating latent failures in those electronics in the old days that used to be very sensitive. KC2QIQ, K2IW, go ahead, Glenn.
Hey, good evening, Dick. I just have a question for you. I remember years ago hearing about cathode ray tubes, not so much about the front being an issue, but back by the yolk was always a possibility of X radiation and possibly other particles coming out of the back of the tube. What's the story on that one? Because I remember even, you know, up until before the LCD monitors with computers, whenever somebody had a monitor on an opposing desk, I'd always try to point or have my sitting area away from the back of the monitor, always being a little fearful about what's coming out the back, I think, much more than what's out the front. Is there any truth to that one? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Got an answer, Dick. Yeah, I'm going to express an opinion on this one. It's the high voltage cage and the high voltage rectifier in there, not the CRT, the back of the CRT itself. I think it's the high voltage cage. What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, I just quickly looking through some of my old stuff, and one of the problems was with the GE sets. There were some GE sets, you remember the Compaqcon, they would leave excessive voltages on the regulator tube, causing it to emit X-rays. Those were recalled, and I think the resulting scandal, so I'm getting this from Wikipedia actually, the resulting scandal was that caused the U.S. agency responsible for this hazard, the Center for Devices and Radiological Health of the Food and Drug Administration, required that all TVs include circuits to prevent excessive voltages in the event of failure. This hazard was eliminated with the advent of all solid-state TVs, which, of course, had no tubes, except for the CRT. So. But the FDA in 1969 limited X-ray emission to 0.5 millivolts per hour.
What's that unit again? 0.5 millirentgens per hour? Is that what you said? Go ahead.
Yeah, 0.5 millirentgens per hour.
Okay. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
This is K2KEYL. You guys just about said what I was going to tell you about what happened. In the back of the set in those days, they had what they call a shunt regulator. It took the high voltage right off the rectifier that they used, a 3A3 at that time rectifier tube. And the high voltage of that was, from the filament, was taken and put on top of a shunt regulator, was called the 6DK4 tube. And that thing was where the X-ray, so-called X-ray problems were coming from. That was the culprit. So what they did is two things. They came out with a new tube to replace it called the 6EL4, 6 Edward Lewis 4. That was a shunt regulator, and you could feel the weight of the tube. I said, what the heck is so heavy in this goddamn tube? And it was because there was a leaded shield in the tube, built right into the tube. You should see a hunk of lead. And also, they added this thing. All the television sets had to be modified. They had to put in this thing called the 4-lead capacitor. I remember it was a red capacitor with 4 leads coming out of it. And this was to make sure that the television set could not exceed certain voltage. In other words, you couldn't twist it up. Eventually, like Eric said, the coming of the solid state, this was eliminated. So But basically, that was the culprit. There was the shunt regulator, Dick, that had the, on top of it, the cap that was being applied about 30,000, 31,000 volts and into that regulator, over.
Yeah, even at that voltage, I think the X-rays are fairly soft and not very damaging. But they can be measured. And how many people are going to sit within a couple of feet of that high voltage cage and dwell there hour after hour? Oh, maybe a cat sitting on top of the television set could get an exposure because of the amount of time he spends there, and because he likes the heat. My grandmother used to have a cat that would sit on top of her television set, and the fur dropping inside would have to be cleaned out periodically. Great stuff. Boy, there are dangers out there we got to worry about. Any pleasant mail? No, we're going through a couple of fun subjects tonight. How's your mail this week? You got it, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Real quickly, a lot of mail came in about this fractal. They want to know about how to make a fractal antenna. Would it be ideal for camouflage? In other words, people got very interested in an antenna that would look like some piece of work of art that you could put out on your patio deck or whatever, and it could be an antenna. And in fact, one question is, and maybe you could answer this. This is an interesting question, that the expedition, there was an expedition called the 3Y0PI, that was the Peter One Island, the DX expedition to this island that was near towards the Antarctic. I remember working them. And the Antarctic wind bent their vertical up, and in fact, it bent one of them in the shape of a question mark. And they said that it worked better. Is there a possibility, like they claim, some people that really said that the expedition said that the received signals and the stations that they were working said that the signal went up 3 to 4 dB better when the antenna was bent. Okay, I'm going to let you comment on this one, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, as I bend an antenna, I may go from horizontal to vertical polarization. And as I shift polarization, will the signal get through that particular chunk of ionosphere between my Antarctic station and the other station that I'm talking to? Absolutely, positively. If this is the best of all worlds and you've got a remote setup, you should set up both a horizontal and a vertically polarized antenna. Because depending on the state of the ionosphere today, as that signal goes through the ionosphere, which is a plasma, it's a conducting media which has a magnetic field mixed into it, that signal that you launch is being rotated some number of times in polarization. If you could see that signal as it goes through that ionosphere, it is rotating like a corkscrew. And when it comes back out of the ionosphere and goes to your buddy in, let's say, South America, you're talking to somebody in Sao Paulo, Brazil, from Antarctica. Should you send a signal that's horizontally polarized or vertically polarized? That's going to change from day to day. And one, during some particular hour of the day, is going to work a hell of a lot better than the other. So the bending of the antenna, I think, changed polarization. Now, there's a slim possibility the antenna had a very high standing wave ratio, and the bend corrected that, and more power came out of the transmitter. But when it comes to fractal-designed antennas, the fractal procedure, you are led to believe when you read the website of fractal antenna manufacturers, the fractal antenna manufacturing companies, you're led to believe that some kind of very exotic mathematics and physics is taking place within the fractal structure. That's what you're led to believe. I can tell you, with no reservation, until you devote a significant number of wavelengths of physical size of the antenna, until you devote a certain number of wavelengths, you have very little control over the antenna pattern and therefore the gain. Now, if your comparison for gain happens to be a very poorly matched antenna or a leaky dummy load or whatever, you'll come to the conclusion that your dipole antenna has got 14 dB of gain over isotropic. No way in hell. And the fractal process, the good news about fractal is because of the way it creates meandering. It is not that different than meandering by way of zigzag or by way of helical winding. It doesn't create a brand new magic. Within a certain kind of fractal structure, you can have two or three different resonances because of the way it meanders, and you may operate at more than one band simultaneously if you desire. But for the fractal procedure to suddenly give you a brand new 5 dB more gain in the exact same physical size, assuming that your original antenna was radiating all the power you're putting into it and it wasn't turning it into heat, the fractal doesn't give you any great magic from my experience dealing with the guy who has the most amount of patents on that subject. He makes some very nice products that work on multiple frequencies in one package. He makes some very nice military antennas. But if you're thinking fractal is going to suddenly give you a zillion dB more gain, I doubt it very highly. And we tried employing that man to do that exact process for us. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. Did you ever hear of a Yagi called the Landstorfer, L-A-N-D-S-T-O-R-F-E-R, Landstorfer Yagi? Is that familiar to you, over?
I might not be familiar with it. L-A-N-D-S, give me the spelling again. Is there a website where I can see a picture of one? Go ahead, Mel.
Was sent a picture of it. It's a L-A-N-D-S-T-O-R-F-E-R, Landstorfer, Yagi. It claims that this it's a three-element Yagi, and that it will have 3 dB more than a regular Yagi of the same type because of the way the elements are bent. It looks kind of weird, Dick, but that's what they sent me a picture of, a little weird-looking thing, and the claim is 3 dB more when the elements were twisted, over.
I just Googled L-A-N-D-S-T-O, oh, I spelled it wrong, T-O-R-F-E, I'm Googling it right now. 3 dB more gain in the same size package. Wow. I'm skeptical. I'm gonna see if I can find it.
L-A-N-D-S-T-O-R-F-E-R, Landstorfer. And I just can't believe it. And the comment was the 3Y0PI when the vertical antenna sort of became something like twisted like a pretzel or whatever you want to call it. That people would claim that their signal increased, whether they were using it as a horizontal, they were picking them up on a beam, a vertical, or whatever, and they claimed it just performed better at their end. So overall, not particularly at one time, not particularly with certain stations, just overall performance improved. And this Landstorfer, F.M. Landstorfer summarized it, and he says, he's not surprised. He says that the Antarctic blizzard made the antenna work better by twisting it over.
Okay, I found an article, A Novel Printed Full Wave Yagi Uda Antenna. Now, if you go to that website that where I talk about getting a perfect impedance match to the driven element of a Yagi, I do talk about the possible magic you'll get if you make the driven element a full wave long instead of a half wave long. You can get some increased performance. And since this article is titled Full Wave Yagi Antenna, I do see the possibility of some extra gain here. The very first diagram that's given, though, says distance in yards versus relative magnitude of current. That's a wild-looking curve. I have never seen a sharp peak of current like that. See, whenever you get a positive peak, it's always rounded. The negative peaks can be sharp, but a positive peak that's sharp, I start becoming skeptical, because people making instrumentation error will sometimes see that. So I wonder if I found the right article so far. Back to you, Mel.
There's a further article I found also by the name of a guy by the name of S-A-C-H-E-R, Sasha. R.R. Sasha summarized a decade of work using bent antennas. And he, oh my God, he's got a chart here and all. I don't know, Dick. got to discuss this a little further. Something here, I'm not sure what to make of it, over.
We've only got about a minute left, and so we should look further into this. I'll search a little bit more. But once you go from half wave to full wave elements, yes, without a doubt, you've got more real estate. You have the capability of some increased performance, increased gain. Now you're talking. This was TechNet number 1,259 of the series that began in September of 1982. Next week will be our let me think, 27th year, is it? Yeah, 27th year. Wow. Thank you for any ribbons there, Mel. Bye-bye for now. Be kind to each other, particularly the people in Bayville. How are you, Mel?
Good night, Gracie, and to we go.
Good night, all, and we'll try to pick up on this next week. It's an interesting subject, this fractal antennas, and maybe we'll look a little more into it. I'll do a little bit also investigating. I'm really has had my sort of my appetite whetted here. That twisting element in some way is going to increase the dBs. I don't know, but we'll go further. 73s, everybody. Take care, and thank you for joining us. This is K2KEY. Good night, all.
Great net.
Now, K2KEY.
Thank you, sirs.
Gracie, you want to meet me over on my mission?
The time is 12 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Internet. Your audio is kind of low, but we're hearing you. Go ahead, Joe.
That's because the node was not turned on tonight and had no connection to the East repeater. You need to check that before the internet, the net started, so, you know, that's why I couldn't check in on IRLP.
I think Eric corrected that during